The audience here at the National Press Club on its feet for 77-year-old labor leader George Meany.
Yes, sir. Mr. President, honored guests, my good friend John Hurley, in the light spirit of John's introduction, may I say, this may be the luncheon that will change the world. Let me first thank the officers and members of the press club for this opportunity to explain the AFL-CIO's views on the administration's economic policies. The issue as we see it is not simply the pay board, nor is it merely the price commission or even the cost of living council. They are only part of it. The issue is the whole kit and caboodle of the administration game plans and phases ever since January 1969 and their dismal consequences for the American people. In the guise of the present anti-inflationary policy, the American people are being fleeced at the supermarket checkout counter, squeezed in the paycheck, and compelled to bear an undue share of the tax burden, while the banks and big business pile up increasing profits sweetened by administration tax bonanzas. Under the pretense of price controls, a rising tide of price increases is eroding the buying power of American families. Profits are free to rise without any pretense of controls whatsoever. Yet the administration's pay board persists in holding down workers' wages. The heaviest part of this burden is on the backs of those at the lowest rungs of the economic ladder, those who are least able to protect themselves. But first, what about the pay board? Despite the AFL-CIO's distrust of the administration's economic policy, we joined the pay board when it was created in late October. We joined it in good faith to give it a fair chance. We joined with the hope that it could bring the voice of workers into the decision-making process of a genuinely independent tripartite body to stabilize wages as a contribution to a total stabilization effort. There was a commitment from the president that the board would be truly independent and tripartite, that the public members would be genuinely neutral and knowledgeable about the realities of labor-management relations. That commitment was not kept. The so-called public members are not neutral. Neither are they independent. The chairman, Judge Bolt, was on the federal payroll as a federal court judge. He represents government. And moreover, and I say this with every feeling of charity, that he has not the slightest knowledge of collective bargaining or industrial life. In fact, when I think of Judge Bolt, I've got to think of one of my grandfather's stories. Got an 9-year-old boy who plays the clarinet. And a week or two ago, they had the first meeting of the school band, he and four other clarinet players, and along with the other instruments, and this was after four lessons. I said to his oldest brother, "How did the band go?" And he said to me, called me Pop Up, he says, "Pop Up, if you heard it, you wouldn't believe it." And if you met Judge Bolt, you wouldn't believe it. Then there's Arnold Weber, the administration's hatchet man. He was an administration official on the federal payroll from January 1969 up to the night of October 21st, 1971. He's the fellow who decided during the freeze that not only were agreed wage increases taboo during the freeze, but that it would be illegal to negotiate for their payment after the freeze. Now, how's that for dictatorship? Up to October 21st, he was executive director of the Cost of Living Council in charge of the freeze. On October 27th, he became a public member of the pay board. He very definitely represents government. The third is William Capos, a former vice president of Inland Steel and a former vice president of the National Association of Manufacturers. His entire career has been on the management side of labor management relations, until he retired in 1968 to become the president of Kenyon College. He, too, is a public member, a so-called neutral. Then there is Neil Jacoby, a conservative economist, who was a member of the Council of Economic Advisers under Arthur Baines and the Eisenhower administration. Since 1959, right up to date, he has been a director of the Occidental Petroleum Corporation. And just 1 week before his appointment to the pay board, he was quoted in a California paper to the effect that all America's economic problems could be solved by holding down wages. That if we held wages down, he said, prices and profits would be no problem for the American people. How's that for a neutral? Finally, there is Kermit Gordon, a conservative economist, one-time director of the budget and the head of the Brookings Institute. I have no personal quarrel with these people, but they are not neutral. They are not independent members of what was supposed to be a tripartite pay board. They are tools of the administration and agents of its economic viewpoint that wage increases are the root cause of the nation's economic troubles. As a result, the pay board has been completely dominated and run by an alliance of the business and so-called public members. All major decisions have been concocted by this group. The labor members have been treated as outsiders, a facade to maintain the pretense of tripartitism. The pay board has been a device to undermine and destroy collective bargaining. It has created confusion and chaos in labor management relations through complex and sometimes contradictory regulations and reporting requirements. It has built up inequities, distortions, and pressures. Responsible collective bargaining agreements have been turned down with benefits to the employers. The rejection of the West Coast Longshore Agreement, for example, will mean a loss of $15 a week to 15,000 housewives for the next 18 months and a $17 million profit windfall for the employers. Now, how this helps to combat inflation has never been explained. $17 million less for the workers and $17 million more for the employers. Remember, this is not the old classic example of inflation where you had too much money in circulation chasing too few goods. This is not that kind of an inflation. We do not have too few goods. We've got all the goods we can use. So when you take $17 million from the worker, put it in the pocket of the employer who has already agreed to pay it, I want to know what that does to combat inflation. If they told the employer that he had to give it back to the consumer in reduced prices, that would be something. In fact, I'd feel a little better if they told the employer to give it to the little sisters of the poor. But what it does to combat inflation, I don't know. On March 22nd, the AFL-CIO Executive Council met and reviewed these matters. We reviewed nearly 5 months of frustrating experience on the pay board. After careful consideration, we decided that the AFL-CIO members would immediately resign. We stated, and I quote, "The board is not tripartite. It is not independent and autonomous. The pay board represents government control. It represents political and business interests. If the wage stabilization program is to be government control, let it be so openly and clearly. Let the people who are exercising the power take the full responsibility for their decisions. Without the facade of labor representation and the pretense of tripartitism, we will not be part of the window dressing for this system of unfair and inequitable government control of wages for the benefit of business profits." That's the end of the quote from the statement of the AFL-CIO Executive Council. The reaction of the administration to our withdrawal from the pay board was almost hysterical. Mr. Ziegler spoke of sabotage. The president himself indicated that labor was trying to torpedo his plans to control inflation. A Mr. Gray of the Justice Department likened us to the robber barons of the 19th century with a blatant contempt for the public interest. Well, I don't recall anything in our withdrawal statement that indicates we want to sabotage or torpedo the anti-inflation program. I state categorically now that we have no such intention. After all, we've got to remember, the American worker is the number one victim of inflation. He pays and pays and pays. He has no tax escape loopholes or other gimmicks that are available to the wealthy and affluent. As to Mr. Gray, I'm sure that when he is confirmed by the Senate as Deputy Attorney General, He will have ample opportunity to do something about the corporate robber barons of the 20th century, some of whom, at least, seem to have an ongoing romance with the Department of Justice as it's presently constituted. To put it in its simplest terms, we withdrew from the pay board because we refused to maintain any further the pretense that the board was tripartite and that its decisions on vital matters reflected the viewpoint of the labor members as well as the viewpoint and opinions of the business and so-called public members. In doing so, we were fully aware that we would be publicly condemned by an administration that is always on the lookout for a scapegoat to carry the burden of its colossal failures in the economic sector. And in this connection, it is important that the pay board issue not be viewed in isolation from its environment. It cannot be separated from the entire complex of the administration's economic policies. It is but one part of the machinery that is now engaged in a massive redistribution of wealth and resources in this country, away from those most in need, and away from public programs of the highest social priority and toward big business and the affluent elements of our society. Even if the pay board were not the stacked deck that it is, so long as it operates as a subordinate apparatus of the public policy, labor could not keep faith with its principles, its members, and the American people by serving as an unwitting cog in that kind of machinery. Our role and our duty is always to resist the policy that works against the ordinary citizen in favor of the wealthy and affluent. And we must of needs remain free to so resist this present policy of this administration. Moreover, we stand on the commitment we have repeated on many occasions since February of 1966. We said then and we say now, we are prepared to cooperate with a fair and equitable wage stabilization effort, if it is even-handed and across the board, with controls on all prices, costs, and income, including profits, interest rates, and executive compensation. But we will not be patsies to an unfair, inequitable, and unjust program that is loaded against the consumer and worker in favor of big business and the banks. We treasure freedom, economic, institutional, and personal freedom. Yet we are prepared in time of emergency to yield a measure of that freedom and accept some constraints if the means exist to regain that freedom and if it is clearly in the public interest, the national public interest, to do so. But we will not quietly yield freedom to a program that is not in the national interest, that does not serve our most pressing national needs, and which is loaded in favor of one segment of our society. I think it would be well to take a good look at the whole economic picture. How did we get where we are today? Where were we economically when President Nixon and his chief economic advisor, Dr. Arthur Burns, with considerable rhetoric, started the administration's war on inflation? Remember this. The Nixon war on inflation started in February 1969, more than 3 years ago. Administration spokesmen refer to the August 15th wage price freeze as the beginning of its so-called war on inflation. For some reason or other, they seem to have obliterated the previous 2.5 years of the so-called anti-inflation war from their memory, and they evidently wish the general public would also forget about it. This is, of course, why they refer to the wage price freeze of August 15th as phase one. Well, to America's wage earners, it was not phase one. Phase one started for us in February of 1969. Let me read one paragraph of a letter addressed to me from the president on the date of February 19, 1969. And I quote, "We must find ways to curb inflation, which robs working men and women and their families of hard-earned gains. And we must do this without asking the wage earners to pay for the cost of stability with their jobs." End of quote. In other words, prices were to be brought under control by Dr. Arthur Burns' fiscal and monetary policies, designed to cool off an overheated economy without causing additional unemployment. Well, where were we in February 69? At the beginning of President Nixon's administration, what were the conditions when Arthur got his paws on the reins? Well, we had an inflation rate of 4.7%. We had an unemployment rate of 3%, or 2,700,000 people out of work. You could get mortgage money on a home purchase for 6%. Then what happened when Dr. Arthur applied his pet theories to our economy? Prices continued to go up, up, up. Unemployment started to climb up, up, up. And within a few months, we had the highest interest rates in over 100 years. And what did we hear from the administration during 1969, 1970, and the first 7.5 months of 1971? Oh, everything was going just fine. The Burns-Nixon economic game plan was working out beautifully. Every statistic that pointed to continued trouble for the American people was hailed as good news, as an indication that the Burns-Nixon plan was an unqualified success. I remember in June 69, when the unemployment figure started to go up, the Assistant Secretary of Treasury, Mr. Walker, made a public statement which he said, well, that proves it. Mr. Nixon's game plan is working. Unemployment's on the way up. I can recall when one of the members of the White House janissariat greeted the news of a jump in unemployment by saying that he was delighted because he had expected it to be worse. Of course, the truth of the matter is that the real phase one of the Burns-Nixon economic game plan was a complete and dismal failure. It resulted in an engineered recession. Unemployment rose sharply from 2.7 million in January 1969 to about 5 million. The number of people living in poverty, according to the government's own definition, increased for the first time in 10 years. The buying power of the average family's income declined. Industry's operating rate fell to about 75% of its productive capacity, the lowest level since 1958, a year of deep recession. Yet inflation accelerated. Living costs climbed 5.4% in 69 and 5.9% in 1970. The high interest rates and the economic slowdown produced by the game plan aggregated inflation. Then new problems were added. Unemployment, widespread economic slack, large and continuing budget deficits, and a lack of confidence. And what happened to the chief architect of our economic failure, good old Dr. Arthur Burns? Did he get the sack, as our British friends would say? Or was he shipped off to Siberia as an economic saboteur, which would have been his lot if he had been a Soviet commissar? Oh, no, our system is different. Arthur was promoted. He's chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, where he can perhaps do some more mischief with his ivory tower pontificating. Of course, he has his whipping boy. They all do. It's part of this political game. You have a whipping boy anytime anything goes wrong. Early in the phase one period, about January 1970, he started to sound the drums for another approach to the nation's economic problems, compulsion for labor. To compel workers by law to work at wages determined by government for the private profit of employers. Oh, yes, he had another brilliant idea. Waive the minimum wage law for teenagers so they could perhaps undercut Papa's miserable minimum. After all, the employer would like this, and Papa could always go on welfare. Then suddenly, last August 15th, the president went on nationwide television and announced a new game plan to combat inflation and lift the sagging economy. There was no reason given for the change, no analysis of past failures. Instead, there was merely the announcement of a new game plan and a new bag of tricks. There was no note of regret on the part of the administration on the sudden demise of the original economic game plan. In fact, there was no mention of any kind in regard to what happened to Dr. Arthur's grandiose plans of February 1969. So the original Phase One went to its grave on August 15, 1971, at the tender age of 2.5 years, unwept, unsung, and unredeemed. Part of the new Phase One plan was a new game plan calling for a 90-day freeze. All workers' wages were frozen, very effectively enforced by the employer. However, not all prices were frozen, and there was no machinery for enforcement of the so-called price freeze. There was no freeze at all on profits or interest rates or capital gains. Another part of the new game plan was a brazen giveaway to big business, a tax giveaway, at the expense of the ordinary taxpayer. Rather than specific programs to create jobs and mass consumer income, as well as a fair and equitable stabilization program, the administration obtained congressional approval of tax bonanzas to business, amounting to over $80 billion in 10 years. The investment tax credit for business purchases of machinery and the speed up of depreciation write-offs amount to an effective cut in the corporate tax rate of about 15% to 20%. These measures are shifting another part of the federal tax burden to low and middle income people. They are depriving the Treasury of badly needed funds to expand public facilities and service. They are also adding to the government's growing financial troubles. The general economic mess has resulted in lower incomes and lower tax receipts, as well as increased unemployment insurance and welfare payments. On top of these kinds of trouble, the administration has given away billions of dollars of tax bonanzas to business. According to the president's recent budget message, the federal debt is expected to rise nearly $92 billion in the four fiscal years of 1969 to 1973. More than twice the entire debt increase of all the previous 24 years, beginning in 47 right up to 1969. It adds up to a massive shift in income distribution from low and middle income people to big business and wealthy families. The tax giveaways are one part of it. The Phase Two program that began on November 14th with the end of the freeze is another part. They are all of one piece, reflecting the administration's view that economic progress begins and ends in the stock market and corporate financial reports. The Phase Two controls program is an example of the administration's flagrant favoritism for big business and the banks at the expense of the average consumer and worker. The price control program, as presently set up, is a sham and a hoax. It's crystal clear and absolutely clear to every housewife. According to the Council of Economic Advisers, 21% of the cost of living is completely exempt from controls. Exceptions are announced almost weekly. Controls have been lifted from 3/4 of all retail stores and nearly half of all rental units. The Price Commission approves price increases on a wholesale basis. On March 27th, the Commission announced that there had been 2,894 price actions with 2,780 approval of price boosts. Moreover, there is no effective machinery to enforce whatever price and rent controls are still on the books. So prices go on up. Or even where the price of an item remains the same, the quantity or quality of the item goes down and the result is a hidden price increase. The consumer is being gouged in the guise of a price control program. But wages are very effectively controlled. The employer who signs the paycheck effectively enforces the pay board's controls. The worker's wages are regulated and controlled even when his employer is exempt from price or rent controls. One of the most shocking examples of the administration's double standard was the flouting of the intent in Congress to exempt low-wage workers from wage controls. On January 19th, the Cost of Living Council, headed by Secretary of the Treasury John Connally and Director Ronald Rumsfeld, decontrolled most retail stores and almost half of the nation's rental units. That's on prices and rents. 10 days later, in the face of the clear intent of the Congress, the same council exempted only wages below $1.90 an hour, less than the amount needed to meet the government-defined poverty line for an urban family of four. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has documented the fact that wages are being held down. On April 7th, today, the Bureau reported that the average hourly earnings of production and non-supervisory workers in private employment, about 47 million people, was $3.57 in March. There was an increase of 1 cent between January and February, and an increase of only 3 cents an hour from January to March. While prices are going up, workers' wages are being very effectively held down. Under these conditions, profits have begun to soar, although the levels of sales are disappointing and unemployment remains high. In the second half of 1971, the Commerce Department reports that after-tax corporate profits were up 19% from the same period of 1970. The major gains in profits are going to the big banks, corporations, and conglomerate giants. The Gallagher President's report shows that the nation's 100 largest corporations scored a 76% rise in profits in 1971 over 1970. If you exclude the special case of General Motors because of the strike situation in 1970, then the record of the other 99 giants was a 70.8% rise in after-tax profits. So the whole issue at this time is the entire economic program and policies of this administration. We have been promised effective policies to combat inflation. Where are they? We've been promised a sharp reduction of employment. Where is it? We have been promised that the administration's international economic measures, including devaluation, would eliminate the deficit in international trade and create 500,000 new jobs. Can anyone find a shred of convincing evidence that this process is even underway? We have been promised and promised for 38 long months, but the record shows that the nation's economy is a general mess, with promises to the people instead of performance. The delivery to date has been favors to big business and the banks, while the people continue to get optimistic rhetoric and disastrous game plans. In a way, I cannot say that I was not warned in advance. A very good friend of mine warned me in 1968 that if I voted for Humphrey, I would see the largest peacetime budget deficits in our history, that welfare rolls would go up higher than ever, that the cost of living would go out of sight while unemployment soared to new heights, and we might even see an American president snuggling up to communist dictators. Well, despite this fellow's warning, I voted for Humphrey, and you see what happened. That fellow was really psychic. But you know, he held back on me. He didn't tell me about the devaluation of the American dollar for the first time since the Great Depression of 40 years ago. Nor did he warn me about the highest interest rates in the last 100 years, nor the first unfavorable balance in American foreign trade in 79 years. Since 1893, we've had a favorable balance of trade. And this year, we went down for the first time in 79 years. Well, it's not a pleasant picture, but let's look at the actual record. Now, this is not propaganda or idle rhetoric. This is the actual record of 38 months of the Nixon administration from United States government statistics. Unemployment, January 1969, 2.7 million or 3.4% of the labor force. March 1972, 5.1 million, 5.9% of the labor force. Major industrial areas with substantial unemployment. The Labor Department figures a major industrial area with substantial unemployment is where the unemployment is over 6% in that particular city or area. In January 1969, we had six such areas. In March 1972, we have 55 such areas. Number of people unemployed, 15 weeks or more. January 69, 334,000. March 72, 1,224,000. Number of workers employed part-time because full-time workers not available. January 69, 1,647,000. March 1972, 2,416,000, meaning 769,000 more in this category. And this is a time when the workforce is growing. January 69, number of workers engaged in manufacturing, 20 million people. March 1972, 18.8 million people, a loss of 1.2 million manufacturing jobs, again, when I point out, at a time when the total workforce is growing. Number of workers in contract construction down 200,000 from January 69 to date. Now let's take the Consumer Price Index. In the 3 months, November and December 68 and January 69, just prior to the start of the Nixon administration, the increase of the Consumer Price Index was at a yearly rate of 4.7%. In the 3 months, December 71 and January and February 72, the Consumer Price Increase Index is going up at a yearly rate of 4.9%. In 1 month alone, February 1972, it increased at a yearly rate of 6%. Another item, the number of people below government-defined poverty line. The most recent information from the United States Census Bureau registered the first increase in this category in 10 years, a rise of 1,200,000 people in that period. Another item, the number of people in this country receiving public assistance. And I think this is really a very, very important item, and it's a very disturbing item because we're getting to the point where you begin to wonder how many people how many people we're going to need to keep one person on welfare. And we're getting to the point where it's going to put us in a real dilemma. Well, the last month of the Johnson administration, January 69, we had 9.9 million people on welfare. October 1971, the last figures I have available after 2.5 years of this administration, we have 14,700,000 people on welfare. An increase in the number of people in that 2.5 years receiving public assistance of 4,800,000 people. Then we take foreign trade. The year 68, we had a surplus of 837 million. In January 1969, in 1 month alone, we had a surplus of 70 million. But in the year 1971, we had a deficit of $2 billion, the first annual deficit, I said before, in 79 years. The deficit for February 1972 was $597 million, or at an annual rate of well over $7 billion. Now let's take a look at the budget. I'm sure we heard people 4 years ago talked about balancing the budget. This was a great emotional objective of some people. Well, for the fiscal year ending June 69, there was a federal budget surplus of $3,200,000,000. This was the last Lyndon Johnson budget. A surplus of $3,200,000,000. For the fiscal year that ends June 72, the president estimates a budget deficit of $38.8 billion, and for the next fiscal year, fiscal year 73, a projected budget deficit of $25.5 billion. The actual deficit this year will be somewhat lower than the official estimate, while the actual deficit for fiscal 73 will probably be greater than the administration's projection. So the overall estimate will probably hold. In the four fiscal years of this administration's budgets, from fiscal 70 to fiscal 73, the combined budget deficits, according to the president's message to the Congress last January, will be $90 billion. And this budget deficit is at a time when the size of the armed forces is being reduced. This combined deficit in these 4 years is 70% greater than the combined budget deficits in all of the previous years from fiscal 47 to fiscal 69. Well, how's that for a record? On the other hand, profits are up. Profits are doing all right. Market is going up. And I'm sure that causes a great deal of happiness over the road in the White House. According to yesterday's Washington Post, General Electric profits are up 13% from the first quarter of 72. And Mr. Joseph Slevin, a conservative, respected financial writer, reports in the Washington Post as of yesterday that American corporations will pick up this year their first $100 billion profits year in the history of this country. So it adds up to profits for the big corporations and the consumer and the worker getting it in the neck. Well, I don't think we should give way completely to despair. Things could change. After all, on June the 6th, 1968, this statement hit the airwaves. The imposition of price and wage controls during peacetime is an abdication of fiscal responsibility. Such controls treat symptoms and not causes. Experience has indicated that they do not work, can never be administered equitably, and are not compatible with a free economy. Well, that was June 68, and the man who said that was Richard Nixon. And then on August 15th, 1971, he said something different. So I don't think we should despair. We can get, changes can happen. After all, any night now, we may get a new announcement of a new bag of tricks from the TV. It may even displace laughing. But the nation's economic and social problems are really no laughing matter, and they require serious consideration and genuine remedies rather than bags of tricks. Now, Mr. Chairman, at this time, I've taken up reading a new book. I keep it with me all the time. And every once in a while, I turn to it for consolation and sometimes for amusement. This is Chairman Mao. This is Chairman Mao's quotations. And some of them are for the kindergarten, but some are not bad. And I refer to this one now. Talk, speeches, and articles and resolutions should all be concise and to the point. Meetings also should not go on too long. Thank you.
President of the AFL-CIO, George Meany, speaking at the National Press Club. Mr. Meany ran on a bit long in his address. That's probably the reason for that quote at the end, but we will have some time for questions.
We don't have time for all these questions, but let's start out with a subject you sort of touched on, which is your relationship with the Nixon administration. The question is, AFL-CIO members have resigned from the pay board, and yet AFL-CIO members are still part of the Construction Industry Stabilization Committee. What's the difference?
Well, I think that's a logical question. When the AFL-CIO Executive Council met on March 22nd and decided that the AFL members would withdraw from the pay board, that action was taken by unanimous decision of the council. And seven largest construction unions are members of that council, and it was a unanimous decision. In other words, they voted for the AFL-CIO members to leave the council, leave the pay board. Now, what's the difference between the pay board and the CISL? CISL is Construction Industry Stabilization Committee. Well, the Construction Industry Stabilization Committee was started last March, just a little over a year ago, and it consists of the representatives of the construction unions, the representatives of the construction industry, and public members under the chairmanship of Professor John Dunlap of Harvard University, who is not only one of the country's leading economists, and I'm quite sure that I make that statement with full knowledge of the fact that there are other leading economists, but he is certainly at the top. He is also a man who, to my knowledge, has been completely knowledgeable on the building industry for the last 25 years or more. Now, they have a tripartite board, and the labor members participate in reaching decisions of that board. And they participate and cooperate in carrying out the decisions of that board. In other words, they lose some and they win some. But they accept the decisions of the board because they are part of the board. They have an input into the decisions of the board, so they respond in that way. Now, technically, or perhaps I might say officially, this paper, the Construction Industry Council, is under the pay board. And while it's under the pay board has not interfered with the Construction Industry Council Commission. Haven't touched them at all. They've made their own decisions and they've carried them out. It's tripartite. They're participating in reaching the decisions, and they're participating in carrying out and cooperating in carrying out the decisions. So on the 23rd of March, the labor members of the Construction Industry Stabilization Committee made this announcement, that they will continue to serve on the committee only so long as the Construction Industry Stabilization Committee continues to maintain effectively its separate and autonomous position, free from the supervision or control of the pay board. So there's actually no difference at all. We were under the control of the so-called public members of the pay board. The labor members on the Construction Stabilization Committee, who take part in reaching decisions. Decisions are reached by people who have knowledge of that industry, and they're reached on the basis of give and take. That they are continuing to serve in that committee. They've been on there since last March. And they've made it quite clear that they will continue to serve, provided that the pay board keeps its cotton-picking hands off.
Mr. Meany, who would be acceptable to labor as public members of the pay board?
Well, I don't like to reach out and pick out name, but I can tell you that I sat on the War Labor Board from its inception in January 1942, right after Pearl Harbor. And I was on there from start to finish. We had people like William Davis as chairman, Frank Graham, Wayne Morse, Lloyd Garrison, George Taylor. We had outstanding public members and we had outstanding employer members. And we battled away and we reached decisions. And we accepted every decision and there was complete cooperation in carrying out those decisions. If we could find people like that, I'm quite sure we'd be happy with it.
A double-barrel question, Mr. Meany. Since some 62 million working people out of 80 million don't belong to labor unions, how can you claim to speak for labor, number one? Number two, what is the AFL-CIO doing to minimize criminal exploitation of labor organizations?
Well, insofar as the people who don't, this so-called 80 million workforce, remember the 80 million workforce includes everybody, it even includes the president of General Motors. He's listed as a worker. It includes the self-employed, it includes domestic workers, it includes people who are perhaps not responsive to trade unions, and it includes people that work for corporations where they don't need trade unions. You know, there are some corporations like that. And in the final analysis, Unless the trade unions have a job to do, unless these people need the trade unions and have a job to do for them, we don't believe in trying to organize them into unions just for the sake of having unions. For that reason, we don't have ball players, we don't have jockeys, we don't have people of that type in our unions, even though they have tried for many years to join the American trade union movement. Now, you say that there are, oh, say 60 million people that are listed in the workforce who are not members of trade unions. How do we pretend to speak for them? Well, we pretend to speak for them because nobody else speaks for them. Who does speak for them? How can anyone speak for them? The mere fact that they are unorganized means that they have no spokesman. And we are conceited enough to think that our workers reflect the ideals and the conditions and the wants of all American workers. And of course, they do toady along, you know. We can document this, that in every area where there's a non-union unorganized field, every time the union wages go up or the union conditions improve, the wages in the non-union field go up and the conditions in the non-union field improve, but they never, of course, reach the same level. So the answer to that is that if the majority of this people in this country don't belong to unions, then I think the president should appoint representatives. Now, how he get those representatives, I don't know. Being the mere fact that they're not organized means that they have no spokesman. Now, you say, what are we doing about the resurgence of racketeer penetration of unions? We have some problems, very few problems in this area within our union. We, of course, have a Landrum Griffin law, which pretty much took this stuff out of our hands back in 1959. But we think all in all that we have a pretty clean setup, and that if we see any resurgence of racketeering, we certainly will do something about it. However, we do have unions in this country, and quite a few of them, and we have them in the New York area, where the charters of these unions are in the office of a lawyer. And he won't have one charter, he may have 10 hanging on the wall. Chartering a union. He charters it, he's the head of it, and so on and so forth. And the way they operate in a lot of small places where there are 60, 100, 200 employees, and they operate on a very simple theory. They hand the employer a wage contract with a check-off. He puts in the wages. He decides on the check-off, and he gives the check-off to these people. There's no meeting. There's no membership cards or anything else. And strange enough, these people do come under the law, the New York State Labor Relations Act, the National Labor Relations Act, and they are to appoint legal. They're legal, at least, until they're caught. So I would recommend that the American Bar Association take a look at this one, because I think they could help us.
I'd like to go to politics. What is organized labor's objection to George McGovern? Why is it so cool to him since he's a liberal Democrat? And number three, if McGovern were the Democratic candidate, would you support him?
Well, as far as who we will support some candidate after the parties have named their candidates. Up to now, they haven't named them, and we're still quite a ways away. The Democrats will name theirs early in July, and the Republicans in the latter part of August. We've sort of wedded to the two-party system, and I'm quite sure that we will support one of the two candidates. Of course, we could reach a situation where we'd be in a dilemma. We wouldn't want to support either one, but I don't know what'll come to that. And you say why is organized labor objection to George McGovern? I don't know. I have no objection to George McGovern at this time, and whether I'd go for him if he was a candidate would depend on what he stood for at that time. But he's a liberal senator. I agree with that. He addressed our convention last year, and after all, maybe the objection of some of our people to George McGovern is they like Muskie or Hubert or somebody else better. I don't know.
Which leads right into the next question, an allied question. Would McGovern make a better president than President Nixon?
I'll have to ask Nick the Greek about that one.
Why do so many labor union members vote for George Wallace?
Well, I don't know how many of them are voting for George Wallace. I know in September 1968, we made a survey. And at that time, early in fact, last week in August, made the survey. At that time, it indicated that Wallace was going to get somewhere between 19 and 21% of the labor vote. But when Election Day rolled around and we had a chance to tell our people all about Wallace, why, Wallace wound up with something like 6.5% of the labor vote, according to our computations and according to outside computations made by people that follow this up. So, after all, Wallace is the best campaigner. Let's be frank about it. He's the best campaigner of this Democratic bunch that's going around. You can't take it away from him. He's talking about taxes. And he's got all the other Democrats over the barrel. He's talking about tax loopholes. We've been talking about tax loopholes for years. But he's got all of them over the barrel because they can't talk about tax loopholes. Because they've done nothing about tax loopholes while they were in the Senate. See, he hasn't been in the Senate. So when they started to talk about tax loopholes, George says, well, why the hell don't you do something about it? You've been there 10, 12 years, so on and so forth. Now, he's a demagogue, but demagoguery is part of American politics. I guess it's part of all politics. He is the best campaigner. And, of course, frankly, I wouldn't touch him with a fork. He's anti-labor to the soles of his feet. He's a racist of the worst kind, no matter what else he pretends to be. But he fools some people, and after all, our members are people, too, and they can get fooled.
If the choice came down to Humphrey, McGovern, and Jackson, which would be your preference?
I'll let you know when I get down to that choice.
It's estimated that labor spent $60 million for Humphrey's presidential campaign in 1968. How much will labor, that is the AFL-CIO, spend for its endorsed candidate in 1972?
Well, you want that in pre-Connally dollars? Of course, the estimate is complete nonsense. We never spent $60 million for anyone or $6 million or anything like that. How much we'll spend for the candidate we endorse depends entirely on how much our members contribute, because that's the kind of money we spend to help candidates. It's the voluntary dollars of our members. How much we'll get, I don't know, but you're at least 90% off in the $60 million.
Is there any Democrat that can beat President Nixon?
Well, again, you're trying to make me a prophet, and I'm not a prophet. Let me say this. If I were forced to make a bet now, I'd bet Nixon's going to win. I haven't the slightest doubt of it. Despite all the nasty things I've been saying about him, I think he's going to win. However, it's a long road between now and Election Day. And if by chance the Democrats should unite, which is a real long shot, they might be able to do something. And of course, I don't know. The president has a lot of options. He's the president, and he's certainly got the advantage. Imagine what would happen if he went off to visit Castro. I don't think the Democratic candidates would even put up a candidate if he'd done that.
Mr. Meany, we certainly appreciate your coming here. And before I ask you the final question, I'd like to present you with the National Press Club Certificate of Appreciation and the coveted National Press Club necktie.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And the last question is, if things continue to go bad here for American labor, will you follow the lead of Bob Short and move the AFL-CIO from Washington?
No, I don't think so. I think we stay put. After all, for God's sake, don't make us as mercenary as Short, please.
A very loud and warm round of applause and a standing ovation for the president of the AFL-CIO, George Meany. speaking today at the National Press Club. And from the National Press Club, and for our technical director, Gary Henderson, this is Jeff Rosenberg, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.